Hate pre-existed Trump, but what he has done as president is mobilize white supremacy. Uno, dos, tres.
Hey, welcome to In the Thick. This is a podcast about politics, race, and culture from a POC perspective. So I'm Maria Hinojosa.
And I'm Julio Ricardo Varela.
We have a really special guest today. Joining us from Chicago is Arjun Singh Sethi, and he's an activist, lawyer, and a writer. He has a new book out called American Hate. Hey, Arjun.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me.
So, Arjun, in your new book, basically what you do is you decide to give voice to the people who survived 13 hate crimes in the United States from December 2015 to May of 2017. So literally crimes that occurred right around the corner. In the very beginning of the book, it's a really powerful introduction because you lay some of the groundwork and the context for what's going on. And you basically say, you know, part of what we have to do is that we have to rethink things.
Right.
And so what happens if you conceive and actively engage on this topic, which is the history of this country was built on a series of hate crimes, beginning with the genocide of Native Americans,
right,
enslaving people, segregation, you know, taking kids away from their Native American families. You write, quote, "Hate and discrimination are not new. They are part of our country's DNA. Throughout it all, targeted communities have learned a painful lesson. The promises of equality under the law and freedom from harm are often the most enduring and dangerous illusions of American life." And then you talk about how what's going on with Trump, though. And we know this, right? That's basically has emboldened this fabric of hate in this country that has kind of emboldened people. And we know that there's been a spike in hate crimes. You write in your book that the FBI reported that 2016 had more hate crimes than 2015, including a 20% spike of anti-Muslim hate crimes. And yet the thing that is seared in my memory as an American, the way that my memories of Martin Luther King, who I was just thinking about this morning, because I was like, you know, I saw him. I was alive. He's not an illusion to me, right? That's seared in my memory. But something else that is seared in my memory is President Trump talking about Charlottesville.
I think there's blame on both sides. You look at both sides. I think there's blame on both sides. What about the alt-left that came charging at the, as you say, the alt-right? Do they have any semblance of guilt? I've condemned many different groups, but not all of those people were neo-Nazis, believe me. Not all of those people were white supremacists by any stretch.
And so can you give us a sense, just define what is a hate crime?
So hate manifests in lots of ways. So there are some forms of hate that are extraordinarily painful and hurtful, but might nevertheless be lawful. So for example, bullying in the classroom, saying something disparaging on the street to a Muslim American, to a Jewish American, to an African American because of who they are, an armed protest outside a mosque, some of the hate that we saw in Charlottesville, those are hate incidents, but they're not hate crimes. A hate crime is in general defined as a crime that would not have occurred absent the protected characteristic of the victim. So for example, somebody targeting an African American, an undocumented person, a Latinx person on account of their identity. And that's in general what we define to be a hate crime. You are absolutely right to point out that according to the FBI's data, there was a spike in reported hate crimes according to their data in 2016. But what is even more striking is how incomplete the FBI data is.
Uh-oh, you're making me worried now. What do you mean?
Yeah, that's an important point.
Yeah.
So according to the FBI, there were something like 6,000 hate crimes that occurred in 2016. But if you look at the National Crime Victimization Survey, there are roughly 250,000 hate crimes that are happening every year.
Whoa.
So why is there that huge gap? That gap exists because the FBI data draws on voluntary reporting from local law enforcement, not mandatory, meaning that local law enforcement are merely encouraged to report data regarding hate crimes to the FBI. It's not required. So in most cases, local law enforcement doesn't bother Or they do report and they just say there are zero hate crimes because they don't want to get a bad rap for hate crimes happening, you know, in their town, in their cities. So that's why we actually don't even know the scope of the problem.
Do we have this hate because it's part of our country's DNA? And if so, then what role does the government play in essentially this administration, this government specifically play in perpetuating, or if they want to, in helping to prevent hate crimes?
It really ties to that bigger, broader question that there is a ugly, dark history of racism, bias, bigotry, and discrimination in this country. You know, as I write in the book, this country was built on a hate crime and was perpetuated and continued through additional atrocities, including slavery, mass incarceration, and the like.
Do we need to specify when you say this country was built on a hate crime and then another one and then another, et cetera, et cetera? Do we need to define this as white supremacy?
Absolutely.
Wow.
And I talk about white supremacy throughout the book. And when we're having these conversations, when we're talking about the history of this country, we do need to have a conversation about white supremacy because so many of these atrocities were rooted in white supremacy. And really, I think in many ways, that's how Trump connects to this history. Hate pre-existed Trump. It will endure long after him. But what he did on the campaign trail and what he has done as president is really mobilize and catalyze a lot of these dark forces, in particular white supremacy, which is why white supremacists are increasingly emboldened and feel they can take to the streets in Charlottesville and target so many of the communities who I profile in this book. So we need to be having conversations about white supremacy. And look, sometimes it takes me 40 minutes to get to the point where I'm about to get to right now, but I love the fact that we share the same politics. So I'll just go ahead and say it 5 minutes in.
Go.
You know, for years, we have been asked as communities of color and as vulnerable communities to have interfaith conversations, to have interracial conversations. And you know what? Those are important. But we also need to have anti-racism trainings. We need to have trainings across this country about anti-blackness, anti-immigrant sentiment, about white supremacy, because that is in so many ways at the core of not just what's happening here, but also what's happening internationally when it comes to, you know, U.S. foreign policy and the like.
But also within our own communities of color, right? You know, when I think about Latinos for Trump, so it's a deeper issue. Right. Don't you think, Arshin? Like, it's almost like we have to look at not only white supremacy, but who are the communities of color that seem to be practicing it? What do you think?
Absolutely. And we have to have difficult conversations, not just with our elders. Sometimes we just blame our elders. We need to have conversations with our peers, with our children.
So what does that conversation look like, though? Like,
well, you know, one of the terms that I was introduced to recently is pigmentocracy.
Whoa.
Right. The idea, right, that we live in a pigmentocracy. And I can tell you that even within the South Asian community, right, if you are more fair-skinned, you typically are treated differently, in part because you can pass as white. And I think we need to have a conversation about just historically the discrimination that people of darker skin have experienced throughout history, which is why I think in these conversations, when we're having these conversations with our own communities, we really have to center anti-blackness and anti-native sentiment. You know, the founders of Black Lives Matter have often said that when black people are free, we will all be free. And in many ways, I think that's an extraordinarily powerful statement, because if you look at the history of this country, anti-blackness is so rooted in our history. It is so entrenched in almost every facet of our society that I think in so many ways, it's actually having that conversation about pigmentocracy, centering anti-black experiences, and having these conversations. Let's turn to our allies and our brothers and sisters in the black community, in the native community, in the Latinx community, who can sit down with our young people, who can sit down with our elders and have some of these conversations.
Yeah, you know, it's just the similarity you just said in the South Asian community. You could take out South Asian community and put Latinx community about who's lighter skinned and lighter skin privilege, and it would be the same conversation. So I totally agree with you. But I want to talk a little bit about your book, because, you know, I want you to plug your book a little bit. And one of the things about your book that's so unique was that you weren't telling the survivors' stories for them. Instead, right, they were consulted at every stage, and they had the final say on what was included in this book because their stories were told in their own words, and you edited it. And you're planning on putting together all these community conversations about survivors in the U.S. on how to combat hate. You say in the book that our damaged country and with fake news, these stories, these voices are more important than ever. So what do you want us to take away from this book in terms of the storytelling?
The process was very important to me, and the testimonial format really gives agency to the survivors. And here's the thing. If you were to, you know, email a survivor and say, hey, write a 3,000-word essay, many of them aren't able to do that, you know, because they're not writers, because they're suffering from physical injuries, PTSD, because they're not in a place where they can reduce their experience, you know, to 3,000 words. So that's what I did. I traveled the country and I met with survivors in their homes and their houses of worship and community centers and worked with them. Recorded the interviews, transcribed the interviews, edited them to, you know, 3,000 to 4,000 words. And I will tell you, there was a moment of anxiety when I edited the interview to 3,000 to 4,000 words in their own words and hit send on the emails to all the survivors.
Whoa.
Because I did have a fear that they would write back and say, Arjun, this isn't our story. But unanimously, uniformly, not only did they tell me that these were in fact their stories, but they found it so cathartic. They found it so healing, and that's why so many of the survivors in the book want to be part of these community conversations across the country that I'm going to be hosting in the cities where they reside. So the process has been really important, and I think it is important to give them agency and to give them ownership.
Agreed.
You know, over their stories. I also think that it gets us closer to a real set of solutions. You know, when I went to Victoria, Texas, and I spoke to the spokesperson for the mosque, Shahid Hashmi, and I asked him just a few months after the mosque in Victoria, Texas was burned to the ground in January of 2017, I asked him, what resources do you need to combat hate in your community? How do you plan on combating hate, right? What can we learn from your experience? He told me that at that point, nobody had even asked him that. Right. Which is stunning. Right. You've got all these pundits. You've got so many journalists saying, here's what we have to do. Here's what we need to do. But if you actually get close to the problem, proximity, and speak to survivors, you will see that they are brimming with wonderful ideas.
So, Arjun, I actually want to ask you, like, if you could give us an example, because we are the geeky journalists, right?
Yes.
And we want to get this right. Mm-hmm. Can you give us an example of how, for example, the mainstream media covered a particular hate crime or situation or continues to cover, and they're not helping the situation. They're making it worse.
Yeah.
Like, how can we do it better?
So a very concrete example, Destiny Mangum and Walia Muhammad. They were the two young women who were aboard the MAX train in Portland, Oregon, when three upstanders intervened. And two of them lost their lives protecting these two young black women, one of them Muslim. And in their story, they talk about how after this national tragedy, they were basically stalked by reporters.
Mm.
They would show up at their door. Somebody actually followed them around.
That's the problem.
And then when they did speak to reporters, here's the thing. A lot of survivors, especially these two young women, they have PTSD.
Yeah.
And when they divulge and share some of what's going on in their life, I think it's incumbent on reporters to handle that with care, right? So if you're going to quote them at length, right, if you're going to work with them, even just checking in on them, right, periodically might be of value to them, right? But when they describe their experience, what they describe is the feeling of being stalked, the feeling of their stories almost being exploited and trafficked for clickbait. Not because anyone was actually trying to help them.
Yeah.
The other bigger, broader point, and this is something that also comes up in the book, is that the other thing the media often does, and this goes back to white supremacy, is that they often talk about these incidents in isolation. So increasingly, there is a recognition, right, that hate has intensified because of the Trump administration and he's courted white supremacists and the like. But even still, there are hate crimes happening every day across this country in some form or another. Yet the media reports them as one-off or as separated, isolated incidents instead of actually talking about how they're often fundamentally rooted in xenophobia, white supremacy, and the like. Yet we don't actually see the media making that mistake, right, when they cover, you know, international terrorism, right? So, I mean, if you look at even just how they portray Muslims and attacks perpetrated by Muslims, I mean, we know from statistics that incidents of violence committed by Muslims and immigrants in the United States get three times as much media coverage as incidents of violence committed in the United States by white supremacists.
One of the testimonies that's in your book is about a Christian Lebanese American family in Tulsa, Oklahoma, where there's actually a Lebanese American community today. And it tells the story of over the murder of Khalid Jabara and his brother and sister Rami and Victoria, and his mother Haifa give the testimony.
My son was saying, help, help.
Moments later, Khalid lay bleeding on the family's front porch. He was rushed to the hospital. His mother was told he was shot in the legs. Khalid died before she got to him.
I said, no way. No way. It's impossible. No way. He was shot in the legs, they told me. He will survive.
Majors was charged with first-degree murder and hate crimes. He pleaded not guilty.
What about that specific story?
So that is an absolutely heartbreaking story, and it's the longest testimonial in the book, and I really encourage folks to read it. So the Jabaras are an Arab-American family from Lebanon that live in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And beginning some years ago, their neighbor started terrorizing them, calling them ISIS, calling them dirty Muslims, dirty Arabs.
Jesus.
And things escalated.
Yeah.
And the neighbor ended up running over Haifa Jabara. This is the mother of the family.
Wow.
He's arrested for running over Haifa. He's placed in custody, awaiting trial. The Jabaras requested the court not to grant bond because he had committed a violent act of hate against the mother, and he lived next door to the family. So initially, bond was rejected. Fast forward, the Jabaras one day get a call notifying them that the suspect has been released on bond.
Wow.
Because a new prosecutor was appointed to the case. He didn't know the history of the case, and he made a mistake. Judges very rarely reverse their decisions on bond, so the suspect was allowed to roam free, moved next door back to the family that he had terrorized for years.
Jesus, this is like a nightmare. This is like a horror story.
Oh, it just gets worse. It just gets worse. Fast forward a few months. Khalid hears gun shooting in the next door neighbor's house. He calls the police and says the neighbor is shooting his gun. Please come.
Wow.
The police come. They knock on the neighbor's door. The neighbor doesn't answer. They come to Khalid's doorstep and say, there's nothing we can do. And Khalid says, what do you mean? He was just shooting a gun. I know he's inside. 5 minutes later, the neighbor shows up at Khalid's house and murders him.
Jesus.
On their front doorstep.
What the hell?
And I met with the family in their family home.
Ugh.
And they will not leave that home because Haifa Jabara talks about how Khalid grew up there.
Mm.
She talked about Arjun, where you're sitting right now, that's where my son learned to type on his laptop.
Mm.
I will never leave this home because so many of my memories of him are rooted in this space. And for me, it would almost be a form of giving up. But it's an absolute tragedy. I mean, there were so many instances where so many different people could have made a difference, right? Whether it was the prosecutor's office, whether it was the police. And the Jabaras feel, and I feel, that if the next door neighbor had been a person of color, you know the cops would have kicked that door down.
Wow.
But because he was a white man, they didn't.
Yep.
They do get that pass. I mean, no, it's very terrible, but it is. I mean, it's kind of amazing to live with that kind of privilege of like, you are not going to be suspected. You just will not be suspected. But in fact, what you're talking about, Arjun, is what it's like to be a person who is the opposite of not being suspected of anything. In fact, we are the targets. And people of color, people of faith, of open faith, LGBTQ people, trans people, we are the target. So we actually want you to talk about the case of Janet Vizguerra.
Demonstrators outside the immigration office in Colorado supporting a mother of four from Mexico, Janet Vizguerra, scheduled to check in with ICE. Unlike other check-ins, her attorney and pastor entered without her.
We're going to go in and talk to immigration. We'll be back in a second.
My intuition is bad.
Vizguera chose not to show up, instead taking refuge inside a church, where she received the bad news by phone.
They denied her stay.
But I don't think people really have the context in terms of anything related to there being a hate crime. So what happened with Jeanette?
It was important to capture the spectrum of hate in this country, which is why, for example, there is a story about bullying, which is why I include stories of vandalism, assault, murder. But I also decided to include what some folks call state-sponsored forms of hate. And that relates to Jeanette's story, because for Jeanette, the idea that immigration authorities could somehow separate her from her family because she's undocumented and they're not was a state-sponsored form of hate. And we really need to be having a deeper conversation, and I do this in the book, and I encourage everyone to do this just in general, about the intersection between state violence and hate violence. If the government puts a target on our back, right, so will the American people.
Is this conversation about that, was that something that she came to you with or that you guys opened up as you were thinking about what to write?
It was a little bit of both. She didn't necessarily use that terminology. Like a couple of the other, like there's somebody, Dominic Evans, who's a trans disabled activist who talks about deprivation of health care for him being a state sponsored form of hate. But really, that's actually what we were talking about. The other thing about her story that I think is also relevant is she talks about how when she was in sanctuary, people threatened to blow up the church because they were giving her sanctuary. So that's another example, right?
I'm sorry. She was getting threats to blow up the church?
Yeah.
Wow.
People were threatening her life and she had to contact law enforcement about it. So she was the target of all kinds of not just bullying and trolling online. People were threatening her life. People were threatening the lives of everybody who came to that church just because they had given her sanctuary. So there is this intersection. Apart from acts of state violence being experienced as state-sponsored forms of hate, there's also an intersection between state violence and interpersonal violence. And that's a conversation that has to be had, and it's a conversation that I hope the book will spur.
Yeah, and I think this is – I'm glad that you brought up both examples, because when people hear hate crimes, they seem to be isolated. What you're trying to do is start bringing this sort of interconnection, that there is an intersectional sort of foundation to what's going on. So, you know, we look at both these stories. These are both cases that kind of have to do with the judicial system, right? And contributing to the inequalities in the treatment of white people versus people of color. So is there a similarity in these stories and how they were trying to get protection or getting justice that kind of goes beyond whether you're Muslim or whether you're an undocumented activist seeking sanctuary or whether you're a black person? What's that common thread?
Well, there are a couple of common threads. The book in general centers women of color, young people. That's because women of color experience and are acutely vulnerable to hate violence, state violence, and gender violence. So really, when we're having these conversations, we need to center them. Two, I do think there was a general alienation among them with the state and the inability of the state to protect them. Or in some cases, right, the state actually targeting them. In the case of Jeanette, it's the state actually targeting her. In the case of the Jabaras, it's the state literally dropping the ball and committing what in any other circumstance would be considered, I'm a lawyer, that's why I'm using this language, absolute
I like this.
Gross
we didn't
negligence,
notice.
Right?
Sorry, go ahead.
I'm sorry. We continue. We didn't want to interrupt.
No, absolutely. But no, just absolute malpractice. So I think there's that. There is a sentiment that these survivors don't have or are sort of losing control of their narratives, are losing control of their stories, either because it becomes a national headline for a day or because it ends up being, you know, used in a report somewhere, which is why, again, I thought it was important to use the format of a testimony. And I will tell you, I've just very recently, and it's very fresh, which is why I'm sharing it, we gave advance copies to all of the survivors, and they were all so moved. I got text messages. I got voicemails. I got calls saying, Arjun, this is amazing. All of the stories are so moving. And you know the other thing that every single survivor I spoke to wanted? They want a survivor's network. there actually isn't a single network that I know of in this country that connects survivors of hate with each other. And the survivors in this book all want to meet each other.
Wow.
Wow. How is the judicial system contributing to these inequalities in the treatment of white people versus people of color when it comes to these types of situations?
And is it going to get worse with what's happening with the Trump administration and the naming of judges?
Okay, so there's a lot.
Well, give us the condensed version, okay?
Okay, got it. Okay,
yeah, lawyerly summary.
Yeah, so here's what I'd say. Again, looking at the history of this country, right? Communities of color have always been disproportionately unfairly targeted by the state and its institutions, right? Whether it's local law enforcement, whether it's the FBI, whether it's CBP. So I do think that a lot of the survivors and their communities generally distrust the police. There is a real issue with some communities being fearful of actually reporting hate crimes, in some cases because they're undocumented, in other cases because they want to reveal their sexual orientation. But in other cases, Muslim and Black communities in particular worry that if they report a hate crime, it could actually lead to surveillance, or it could lead the FBI to send in a confidential informant into the mosque.
Yeah.
So there is a lot of mistrust. And they also feel like they're not centered in the adjudication process. Concrete example, Asma al-Bukhai, it's the first story in the book. She was the first Syrian refugee to ever be resettled in the state of Idaho. And she talks about how her son one day was punched to the ground in Boise because he's Muslim. And when she was in court and asked by the judge, what should happen to the suspect who punched your son? Her response in that moment was, I don't think the suspect belongs in jail because the suspect isn't going to learn about Muslims, refugees, and Syrians in jail. So regardless of ultimately what we decide and what the criminal justice response is, in this case, the court didn't care. But ultimately, the person was sentenced to jail. And maybe that was the appropriate sentence. But I'm just raising the broader point that a lot of impacted communities and a lot of survivors distrust the system and distrust the government. Mm. You know, your point about litigation and the remaking of the judiciary, this is a really important point. And I actually want to emphasize one thing. People don't understand the damage that Trump has done to our judiciary. And I think what you're going to see going forward in the years ahead is that our courts collectively are really not going to be a vehicle for vindicating our rights. Because that's what happens when you appoint conservatives who have, in many ways, biased politics, politics that, yeah, call them biased, racist politics. I mean, in many ways, that's what it is. They're not sensitive to civil rights. They're not sensitive to human rights. They're not sensitive to the types of cases that the people in this book would bring. And I think that that actually bears immense consequence for our work going forward. So post-Trump, there's been a lot of emphasis on litigation as a form of social change. And here's the thing. If you're a litigator and you have a federal case, you can often pick your jurisdiction, right? You can pick the jurisdiction and say, you know what? I have a feeling that I'm more likely going to win in that court, and I'm going to bring the case there.
Right.
And that's increasingly what a lot of organizations have done. But it's unsurprising that as the appellate process works its way up, we're increasingly losing, which is why we lost the Muslim ban case at the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
And I think that's increasingly what's going to happen. We can try to handpick our cases and win at the local level. But as we go higher and higher, we're going to get more and more defeats, which is why one of the things we have to do is really emphasize community organizing, emphasize local advocacy, and encourage folks of color, young people to run for office and just build capacity in all these various ways, independent of litigation.
So, Arjun, just to finish up, your personal narrative and what your personal narrative, how it ties into the work that you're doing and who you are today. For you, for example, you're Sikh American. How did that play into the fact that you decided to do the work that you do as a lawyer and then to write this book, giving voice to the victims of American hate?
So I am a Sikh American, and I can be identified by visible articles of faith, including my long hair, which I cover with a turban, and my beard. And Sikh Americans have been acutely vulnerable to bullying, hate violence, and the like, really for years. The anniversary, actually, of the Oak Creek tragedy, it's Sunday, August 5th. And some years ago, a white supremacist stormed a Sikh Gurdwara in Oak Creek, Wisconsin.
Yeah, I remember.
and killed half a dozen worshipers and injured so many more.
Seven people shot dead at the Sikh temple in Oak Creek. That includes the gunman. Autopsies are scheduled for tomorrow.
The FBI surrounded and then presumably searched the gunman's home.
And it was a terrible hate crime. And the truth is, Sikhs have always been vulnerable. And part of my response to that vulnerability is to resist, is to push back, is to do this work, whether it's documenting these stories, whether it's working with communities and prescribing, you know, best practices in the future, whether it's advocating in the courtroom, you know, for the rights of the vulnerable. And the last point I will make is Sikhs in general have always tried to be servants of justice, servants of peace. Mm. And it's a really proud tradition, and it's a very important, proud part of my identity. And, you know, no matter what happens in my life, no matter what comes tomorrow, you know, I know that I will always be able to look back on this moment and know that in this moment of terrible pain and grief, I was able to provide some hope and some consolation and a venue for survivors to share their stories and for communities, you know, to come forward.
Wow. Arjun Singh Sethi, thank you so much for all of your work and for your book, American Hate, and for being the lawyer, activist, writer, thinker, patriotic American that you are. Thanks so much for joining us on In the Thick.
Thank you so much. It was just such a pleasure.
I'm Maria Hinojosa.
And I'm Julio Ricardo Varela.
Uno, dos, tres.
And remember, dear listener, go to Apple Podcasts right this very minute. Rate and review us. Follow us on Twitter and on Instagram at In the Thick Show. Like us on Facebook. And by the way, tell your familia to listen and your friends, because that is the way most people find new podcasts, is by word of mouth. So talk about it. In the Thick is produced by Juan Pablo Garnham, Stephanie LeBeau, and Nicole Rothwell. Our theme music is Comencemos by Jungle Fire. The music that you heard is courtesy of Nacional Ket and CCK Records. We will see you next time on In the Thick. Thank you so much for listening to In the Thick.
Nos vemos.
See you later. You guys, I'm sorry. I have a mouthful of food. Hold on a second. I cooked dinner last night.
You cooked?
Yeah, exactly.
Amazing. Food brings joy.